Welcome, listeners, friends, and enemies. Thank you for tuning in today. We are glad to have you here with us wherever you're from. I'm Henrik Palmgren from Sweden. RedIceCreations.com is our main website where you can find much more of what we do. Mike Walsh has been a professional writer since 1975. From Britain, he provides international media with thought-provoking articles covering human, global, and political issues. He is both a popular poet and a free-thinking writer. Walsh's books seeks to torpedo the propaganda of the victors and give us a different side of the story that we're told. He joins us to speak on the subject matter of his latest books, Heroes Hang, When Traitors Triumph, and also Heroes of the Reich. We are going to begin to talk about T.E. Lawrence, or Lawrence of Arabia, as you might know him, and discuss his and some of his influential friends' views concerning the looming war with Germany at the time when they were alive. And then later in the second hour, we'll speak of Quisling, Vidkun Quisling from Norway, and Knut Hamsun, and share some information with you that very few, I believe, ever have heard in an effort to try to save the honor of these gentlemen's names from the ravaging lies of history by those who have written the history. Welcome, Mike Walsh. Thank you so much for joining us today. Hope you're doing well. It's lovely to have you on the program.
Well, it's a great pleasure to be with you, and this is the first time, and I hope that it won't be the last time. I always enjoy talking with the audiences over the airwaves.
You bet. Thank you, Mike. It's great to have you here, and I wanted to bring you on because I recently stumbled across one of your books, and I know you have three out now. We can talk more about them later, but one specifically that caught my attention is Heroes Hang, When Traitors Triumph, because you actually go into, in the book, various personages, historical, that have, of course, been over time demonized, and one of these is Vidkun Quisling. Our Scandinavian fellows will know who this is. He's quite famous internationally, too, by the way, but interesting how his name has been associated with various things. You talk about Knut Hamsun as well, another Norwegian, and this is a very interesting story, and I've always been curious to hear the other side, if you will, to this argument. But first here, Mike, tell us, how did you come to write Heroes Hang, When Traitors Triumph? How did you get on this track?
Well, many, many years ago, more years ago than I care to remember, I was concerned, particularly concerned, at the propaganda of a negative type about the entire period between the so-called Russian Revolution and the period running up through the Third Reich and the end of the Third Reich. And I set out, I wrote a book many, many years ago, about 30 years ago, and it was called For Those Who Cannot Speak, because these people were either all dead or they were gagged by the mainstream media. So nobody was speaking for the other side. And it was rather like going to court and finding a prosecution but no defense. So I took some of the biggest whoppers and I put them into book form and I made the corrections, which would give people an insight into the Third Reich at the period, which was quite contrary to the propaganda of the victors, so to speak. And one thing led from another there. Then that was enthusiastically received, Henrik. And then the next one was, I was particularly upset by an American account of the destruction of Hamburg. And there were parts of the books that I was reading when it caught my interest that upset me so much, the effects of the firestorms on the ordinary people, that I really had to leave the book down and go away and compose myself. And I thought, well, this sort of thing can't go unanswered. So the next book was called The Death of a City, which some people thought was Dresden, but a lot of people forget that there was not just one Dresden. There was, I think, 56 major cities that were burned to a cinder by the Allies, by the United States Air Force and the Royal Air Force. And, you know, the implication is that only Dresden suffered. Well, Hamburg and Berlin suffered every bit as badly as they did and probably lost almost as many people. So that was that book. And then the next thing, one of the problems that I have had over the years, Henrik, is that because I'm I suppose I have a gift for writing and analysis of these things, but I'm not particularly, the brightest tool in the box when it comes to computers and that sort of thing. So I was always behind the door when other people were taking my works and pirating them. So some of my books have been out there, and I'm not earning a penny from them. I have been working for 40 years, and I've never earned a penny royalty, but other people are doing quite well out of them, thank you very much. But late last year, I had a friend, because I am a ghostwriter as well, who said, "Oh, why don't you put them on Amazon?" And I thought, well, that's a bit of a challenge too far for me. But I got the assistance of my wife, Nadezhda, and together we got through the problem. So now, Henrik, all of my works are coming together, and they are, you're going to see by the end of 2015, 16 books. Some of them have been around for a long time. But they're going to be retitled and modified and severely edited. So they're not going to be the same books in that respect. But I think I'm going to light an awful lot of candles through Europe.
Well, right. Very interesting. Now, there's been pressures, by the way, put on Amazon.com and things like that to stop selling material that gives us a different version, different side of the story. And I guess still to this day, many people have an approach that, you know, we know everything about this period now. We know that they were evil. So why bother looking in this direction? Why bother to look at this material or even try to see, you know, anything that occurred from an objective perspective? What would you say to the people who still have a view like this on history, of a one-sided view, who don't bother to go the extra mile to see, you know, why has these people been demonized? What really happened, etc.? How do you usually answer questions like that to them?
I don't think you're always going to get in any society people who are totally apolitical. They're not the slightest bit interested. And as my own son, who's in his 30s, said to me, he said, the Second World War is what the Crimea War was to you. It's history. Put it to bed. And I can understand that coming from his age group. But I think that, I was writing today on the latest book that I've just produced, is wars and conflicts of the past, they eventually go to sleep and they just become, something of minor interest, except the period of the Third Reich. And this is a form of government, a completely new revolutionary form of government that is just not going to sleep. It is not going to, if they can sing all the victory lullabies all of their life, but it's just not going to go away. And somebody said to me again years ago, they said, you know, for 300 years after Jesus Christ was crucified, people couldn't say his name without spitting on the street.
Right. Yeah.
And he was that reviled. And yet everywhere we go, where I live now, I can't walk 1 kilometer without seeing a church. And wherever you're speaking from, Henrik, I'm sure that you can't walk 1 kilometer without seeing a church.
Yeah.
And after 300 years, after all 2,000 years after they said that Jesus Christ was dead, you know, he is the biggest figure around the world. Now, apparently, there's figures are difficult to back up, but apparently Mein Kampf is the second biggest selling book in the world even today, 70 years after this prophet took his own life. It's second only to the Bible. So Hitler is simply not going to go away, and this is what they're afraid of today, is that, as in the case of Jesus Christ, he will start capturing the imagination of the generations that you have just been this moment talking about. And because of the onset of the internet and because of the onset of independent radio stations like yourself, you know, the world that has been closeted away and held captive by the mainstream media, by the editors' desks of the newspapers, and by the publishing houses. These people are all liberated now, and they can get the information forever, wherever they can. And it was Julian Assange who said that the internet is burning mainstream media to the ground, and it is, and this is what concerns them.
Yep, you're right. Now, so would you say today that we're living kind of in the post-World War II reconstruction era, and that this is one of the reasons why it's so important to try to understand the period, to try to because we're all wondering what kind of world would it be if the outcome was different, right? It's one of these things when we today have as you said, a banking system that's completely controlling the world, a news media that's absolutely controlled, an eroding identity all over the Western world. It's turned into a kind of very shallow materialistic view. Do you think anything would have been different today if the outcome of these two world wars turned out in a different way? Would we be in a different place today, do you think?
Yeah, you're giving me an inspiration for Book 17, aren't you? I think the world would have been a far different place because, again, I have a great number of Russian friends who I dearly and absolutely love. But they are digging their own grave by associating Vladimir Putin with Bolshevism. The Germans, bless them, never ever had a problem with Russia or the Russian people. The two have always got on very, very well together throughout the centuries. The problem that the Germans had of the Third Reich period, and this was conceded by the likes of David Lloyd George, is that it was Bolshevism. It was not Russianism, it was Bolshevism. So, again, there was no such thing as a Russian revolution. It was a coup that was financed by Wall Street, and it has its carbon copy in what is happening in Ukraine today. Washington has sent their emissaries in, they've created a coup, it's been a regime change, they've put their own men in, and what you're seeing in the Ukraine, in Kiev today, is very similar, the same principles as what happened in St. Petersburg in 1917. And, they've put their own people in government. And history is repeating itself, and we've got to learn from this. Otherwise, we're going to suffer, just as the Russians did in the 1920s.
Yep, good point. Now, let's get into talk a little bit more here about the people that you bring up in Hero Sanguine Traitors Triumph. You begin with Lawrence of Arabia, a very interesting story, and you brought a couple of things up which I've never heard about before, but maybe you can just refresh our memory a little bit about his accomplishments, what he did, and then later we can talk about his fate and what happened to him.
Yeah, although I'm of Irish nationality, I was born and brought up in Britain, so I can't talk for the legends of other countries, but in England, Lawrence of Arabia, or T. Lawrence, to give him his correct name, was such a heroic figure that there would have hardly been a house in the length and breadth of Britain that would not have had his pictures on the sideboard, excuse me, or, his books, the Seven Pillars of Wisdom and the rest of it. He was truly an iconic figure in England. And because of this, because he was held in such high esteem, he carried an awful lot of weight with the British people. And when he got together with Henry Williamson, who was a well-established and much-loved author, I suppose in some respects, not too far removed from your own Knut Hamsun, between the two of them and Oswald Mosley, who was the leader of the British Union of Fascists, the three of them carried a lot more weight in Britain than did Winston Churchill, whose reputation at that time was certainly a shadow of what the mainstream media has made it today.
Right.
Now, just to be coming up to a critical point, it was decided that after an awful lot of navel gazing, because he really didn't want to. He wasn't really a political animal, was T. Lawrence. He decided to get together with Henry Williamson and, you know, Tark of the Otter, the writer of Tark of the Otter, and to arrange a meeting with Oswald Mosley in which they were going to affirm their support for the British Union of Fascists. And the main theme at the time was no war with Germany. And had this meeting commenced the following day, then I doubt very much whether the war lobby led by Winston Churchill would have got its own way. And that's how critical it was. And for that reason, he had to be removed one way or another. And, of course, he was assassinated. But then again, assassination for the Western powers is pretty much normal procedure.
Tell us what happened here, then. What do you think, what happened with T.E. Lawrence? Obviously, this is one, you mentioned one of the reasons why he potentially was taken out, if you will, but we've heard that he died in an accident, right?
Yeah, well, it was an accident very much similar to General Patton, wasn't it? He lived in a very, very beautiful, if you picture in your mind, Devon, in England. You know, it's a sort of part of England which is so picturesque that you see it on chocolate boxes and Christmas cards and, you know, it's beautiful mountains and Dartmoor. It's a place that I was very, very familiar with. I used to stay down there. You know, the story of Lorna Doone. It was a wonderful place. Now, you're talking about a very rural area where you can drive along on your motorbike for probably 20 minutes and at that time maybe meet a tractor driver. So off he goes on his Brough motorbike to meet Williamson, and there was two schoolboys cycling along the country lanes in the vicinity, and then all of a sudden a black car came out of nowhere, came down the lane and was involved in, as you say, an accident, and I'm putting my fingers up behind my ears here. And, you know, the accident was, it was fatal, and he never recovered from his injuries, and we lost one of the greatest heroic figures that England had ever had. He was on a par with Nelson, and that was the way he died. And from there on, a screen of secrecy was set up. The inquest, which is necessary by law, this did not follow normal procedure at all. It was held at an army barracks, and there was the suicide of the only sentry who was on at the time to witness the people who were coming and going. It was a whitewash, if you like. There was a lot more evidence, for instance, of his being assassinated than there was of Kennedy being assassinated. It was, the circumstantial evidence was 100% that he was murdered. The schoolboys who had partly witnessed, imagine in your mind they're just enjoying a summer's day, and about, you know, it's not really to be expected that they would remember too much detail, but the car that knocked them off, it was never identified, but the people who made the Brough motorbike upon which he was riding, they found flecks of paint, which was from a black car, so they were able to narrow it down again to a government car. So the circumstantial evidence is that it was an assassination of, you know, one of the great heroes of Britain, and that was the reason. Nobody can be in any doubt that had T.E. Lawrence, Lawrence of Arabia, of which the movie was made, had stayed out of politics, had not given his support to Oswald Mosley, then he would have lived, you know, as long as his contemporaries at the time.
Interesting. Now, you did bring up the movie, and I guess it speaks a little bit to, unfortunately, my generation. I have not had time to read much about T.E. Lawrence, but I did see the movie from 1962 with Peter O'Toole. Have you read about him? Is there an act, an accurate portrayal of what occurred in the movie for those who want to see it?
No, it was a little bit difficult. So you could, if you're going to look for similarities, I would say Dr. Zhivago. So yes, in that respect of the period, there was a great deal that was empathized with what was happening. But when it came down to the detail, no. But do bear in mind that at the time, T. Lawrence of Arabia, was very much pro-Arab. And we certainly need somebody of his stature today. He was very much in favor with the Palestinians because Palestine at the time was a beautiful country,
yeah.
Very much like Lebanon when I was there as a young man. It was a wonderful infrastructure, a wonderful tradition. Now it has been totally destroyed and splintered and it's gone. One can only hope that it comes back. And so for this, the Arab peoples of the period and of the location, he was for them a great heroic figure. And, you know, he was fighting their battles, and T. Lawrence was not happy at all about the Balfour Declaration. So that says much in his favor. And the T. Lawrence, these kind of people, they were always very, very highly principled people, even if I didn't agree with them on their politics. One had to accept that we had more principled people in the 1920s and the 1930s than we do now, for instance, which, as you quite rightly pointed out earlier, is a very, very shallow, materialistic, celebrity-influenced society that we live in.
So
in that respect, Henrik, it was a totally different era, and he was not in favour. He did not like the way British foreign policy was conducting its affairs. They were betraying the Arabs, but then again, what's new there? Perhaps he was a little bit naive, but you know, the British are always being perfidious. You know, there is an expression, isn't it? Perfidious Albion, or Britannia waives the rules, which they always have done. I think there's only Spain, which has been, involved in more conflicts in the last 900 years than Britain, and they're pretty close neck and neck. And I think one is 58% and Britain is 56% of the time involved in conflicts somewhere. I believe that there is only 22 countries in the world that have not been invaded at some time by the British. And they have the cheek to do a bit of finger wagging at the Germans. The Germans, bless them, have only been involved in wars for 8% of the period. For the same period, and that includes the blasted Prussians as well.
Well, that's what I've been so amazed by, and so, you know, that there's this incredible demonization of Germany by the so-called Allied powers. But there's no recognition of what they did, or you know, just as you said, how many wars they were a part of, or no self-reflection on this whatsoever, which makes the situation that much more interesting. But I wanted to ask you one more thing about Lawrence here. We don't have to spend too much time on this alone, but, you know, I got the impression that, of course, that he managed to unite many of the Arab tribes, the Bedouins, in a way that none had before. And I got the impression that he kind of did this on behalf of the British Empire, but this is not really the full story then. He didn't turn against them in some way now, did he?
No. He always stayed... He did well with the Arabs simply because he believed in their cause, and while that cause coincided with British foreign policy, of course he worked with the both. But then when it no longer suited British foreign policy to form an alliance and give their support to the Arabs, then of course he stayed true to his beliefs. And he supported the Arabs. You know, in the same way, if you want an analogy here, it's the way Britain, promised the earth to Poland in 1938. And then they were the first to stab them in the back and abandon them. And, you know, this again was typical of Britain at the time, is that once the Arabs had served their purpose, in the war against the Turks, and they were discarded. And this was something that the likes of principled people like T.E. Lawrence just couldn't live with, and he didn't want to be a party to it.
Yeah, it's very, very interesting. You know, Britain is certainly turncoats, as they call it. There's one book I read, it was many years ago now, I think it was called The Empire of the City by, was it E.C. Knuth or something like that? But anyway, he detailed in the beginning of the book how Britain kind of changed sides, basically from the Napoleonic Wars all the way up to, well, he lists all the way up to, yeah, he does go into World War II, by the way, that's right, I thought it was World War I, but he shows how they, you know, one year they stand with Russia, then the next year they allied with France against Russia, and then they join in with Germany and the Austro-Hungarians to go against Turkey, and then they go with Turkey to go against Germany. It's back and forth like this all the time, and it's just amazing that these other countries were willing to work with them when they, you know, the year previous had been against them and things like this. It's amazing, isn't it?
Absolutely, and I'm surprised that anybody takes them at their word, and they still do now, and people are saying now because we've got, you know, this anti-modern Russia theme going on at the moment. And I say to my friends in the Baltic states, do you really for one moment believe that NATO will come to your assistance?
Right.
I said the Russian army will be in Riga within 24 hours. I said, and you will not see the American heels for dust. I said, they'll be well away. They will do exactly to the Baltic states as Britain did to Poland, and they'll just get the hell out of it.
Yeah, yeah. Now, Lawrence died then in, was it May 19th, 1935? This is kind of way before, really. Obviously, the Second World War has gotten underway, but, you know, maybe there were inclinations at the time of what was about to occur. I don't know, but that's fairly early if he would put him support behind, you know, or rather not wanting to go to war with Germany and trying to lobby with some of his influential friends on this cause. What do you think would have happened if he didn't die?
I think that there was a tremendous anti-war. I think if I'm quite right on my figures, it could be 70%. It could be 77%. So don't crucify me if I get it wrong. But Chamberlain, who was Prime Minister at the time, he said, my mailbag next week was typical. He said 77% of the mail that I received from the British people were saying that under no circumstances must a declaration of war be made against Germany. Now, I don't have them to hand. I have published them. But the list of very, very influential people, including the Duke of Windsor, King Edward VIII, who were really against having declaring war against Germany, they were a very, very, the anti-war lobby was absolutely massive. The British Union of Fascists at Olympia held the biggest rallies ever in British history. 70,000 used to be turning up at them. And, you know, you're talking an awful lot of people. So at the time, the pro-war lobby, and remember that the campaign had been conducted much more robustly than the sanctions are being applied against modern Russia now. We are seeing history repeating itself. But the sanctions and the rhetoric and the narrative against the National Socialist Germany since January 1933, and we're talking about the killing at the end of 1935, had been growing in intensity. So, yes, in 1935, 1936, most of the astute British people, or those people that are influenced, they knew that the British government was chasing the pound. There's always money to be made out of conflicts, and this is what they were up against. There is no money to be made out of peace, but as long as the, you know, the nose for war gets the sniff of the almighty dollar or the pound sterling, then I'm afraid they're going to go into the ascendancy, and the best that we can do is to try and stop them.
Mm-hmm. Now, this is very difficult for us to understand today because we are still very much propagandized into viewing this on a, you know, black versus white or good versus evil level. But at the time, just as you said, there was a lot of people that were friendly towards Germany. They were impressed with the way they had turned things around. You know, Hitler ended up on the front cover of Time magazine, and of course, all the things that consequently happened later on is something that's been kind of used against us historically. The things have been turned and convoluted. It's very difficult to get to the real truth and to kind of pierce through the noise of the propaganda, if you will. But how do you think the British at the time managed to turn the tide? And Churchill, was it really some of his speeches that managed to do this, or did they propagandize the British people in the media, or what happened there, do you think?
No, he was paid an enormous sum of money. Basically, Winston Churchill was bankrupt. And, you know, for an ego like his, this was, and a reputation to protect. For him to go bankrupt would have, well, he may as well just take his own life, really. It was that bad at the time. And it was Strachish. You'll have to forgive me because I don't have any literature in front of me. It was Strachish. Now, they were connected to the Oppenheimers, and they desperately wanted a war with Germany for a number of reasons. It wasn't any one particular reason. Winston Churchill said it was a trade war. Baker, the American Foreign Secretary, conceded as much. But there was a lot of people involved in the declaration of war who were getting what they particularly wanted out of it. And, of course, the Oppenheimers and the Strachers, they had their own reasons for getting rid of somebody who had put them into second place in the Reich.
Is there anything else you want to say about how the tide was turned? You talked about Churchill and, of course, that he was paid off, if you will, but it was still about the way of how to go about changing the mentality of the British people. Or do you think that the Brits were still very much against it, even when England had declared war on Germany?
You're absolutely right with the latter point. There was no enthusiasm for the war whatsoever. You know, nobody wanted to be conscripted. Nobody wanted to go to war. And it was very, very much a coup when Winston Churchill, the war was what they called the Boer War. In between September the 3rd and June the 6th, when absolutely nothing happened. And this is why it was called the Boer War, not the Boer War, the Boer War. People were yawning and saying, what's happening? Well, nothing was happening. Half of Poland had been occupied by the Reich, the other half had been occupied by Stalin, but absolutely nothing else was happening. And it looked like this was just going to fizzle out. And so Churchill had to have his war. Something had to be, you know, black flag operations, well, call them what you will. Something had to be galvanized to get the country into war and get them behind him. But he had no following at all at the time. He was viewed by most British people as a repugnant. He was not a popular figure at all. He was a very good orator, but so what? He was a very good orator, and Parliament is not democratic at all, and it does what the politicians want to do, and the politicians are in the pockets of certain people. So again and again and again through history, the British people, and no doubt many other people in many other countries, were just hijacked. These wars are carried out in their name, but you know, it was a minority thing. I always point out that they say this was the war of the dictators, and the great irony of this is that the four main protagonists, Joseph Stalin, Winston Churchill, Roosevelt, and Adolf Hitler, there was only one who was popularly elected, and that was Adolf Hitler. The other three were dictators. Stalin, of course, was never elected. Winston Churchill was never, ever elected to prime minister. He was parachuted in. Mm-hmm. And Roosevelt, he got in, but as it was admitted later, he squeaked in by a very, very narrow margin. And had he not promised and lied to the American people beforehand, and this was conceded afterwards, that they would not involve the America into any more European wars, then Roosevelt would never have been elected. So I don't regard that man as being properly elected. Had he sold me a car, I would have had every right to get my money back. So he was not a president, an elected president in that sense. The only man who was popularly elected on two occasions was the German leader.
Interesting. I did not know that. Now, tell us, before we move along here a little bit, obviously I want to get to Quisling here a little bit, but Henry Williamson, you briefly mentioned him. He was a friend of Lawrence, and he was... So they were working together, and they managed to wield some influence in Britain at the time, is that correct?
Oh, yeah, they were very close. They were friends. They were friends, and I suppose, as was the case with everybody else in England, and no doubt Germany at the time, you know, current events was very much the in vogue. Just as you and I, and you know, everybody talked about the standoff with modern Russian, Putin's Russia now, people were talking about the British relationships with Germany. So they were very good friends. They lived very close together in rural Devon, and they were seeing each other. Both of them were extremely intellectual. A lot of the intellectuals at the time were very, very pro-fascist, or pro-national socialist, because there is a marked difference between the two of them. And some of the great writers and poets and other people of this genre were very, very sympathetic towards National Socialist Germany. So Hitler at the time was not the bogeyman that he is today. And, of course, this has all been hidden by the propaganda of the victors. It gives me, you know, a cue to another thing that I would point out. Adolf Hitler was the Chancellor of Germany for 12 or 13 years, and yet all we ever hear about is about 3 years, whatever happened to the rest of them. Nobody ever figures out is what was Germany like between 1933 and 1940. In 7 years, the Third Reich. There is nothing there. If you're going to look on television or in the films or in the books and all the rest of it, it's all between 1940 and 1945. 4 years, and yet the Reich was there. Mm. So, yes, these two men would have talked together, and at the time there was a very, very strong sentiment against war with Germany. Remember also that at the time there was an awful lot of collaboration. There were students being exchanged with Germany. A lot of English people were working in Germany. Many Germans were working in England. So you had the sort of relationship that you've got with England and Ireland, and perhaps, for all I know, between Sweden and Norway, this coming and going. So, yeah, people could travel to Germany. They could go wherever they wanted. The one problem is, and you asked me a question earlier on, and a question that I often ask myself, which is related to what you asked, is, had the internet existed at the time, and broadcasting organizations like your own existed at the time, could war have been avoided? Now, was the war caused by mainstream media beating the war drums and excluding all opinion other than their own? And I hope that if there is going to be a third war avoided, and we will have the internet to thank for it, and broadcasting, independent broadcasting organizations like your own.
Yeah, I think that's one of the reasons why the propaganda surrounding how they try to ramp up conflicts have changed very much. I think we've seen this with the various so-called spring, like the Arab Spring, for example. They topple leaderships from within the country by using very dubious means. We might get an opportunity to talk more about that later, but I wanted to ask you and read something here. In 1935, Henry Williamson visited the National Socialist German Workers' Party Congress at Nuremberg and was greatly impressed, particularly with the Hitler Youth movement, whose healthy outlook on life he compared with the sickly youth of the London slums. He had a well-known belief that Hitler was essentially a good man who wanted only to build a new and better Germany. He was opposed to war and believing that wars were caused by usurial money interests, and he was attracted to, you know, mostly, as you said before. But, you know, from viewing it from our timeline, then, if I can put it that way, it's difficult for us to understand why these seemingly intelligent, academic people were attracted to this wicked, evil ideology. But that only makes sense if we assume that you know, they knew what we have been told today about what these organizations were trying to do, like the National Socialist German Workers' Party, for example. It's, in other words, there's a disconnect here. There's, it doesn't make sense that some of these people would be attracted to some of these ideologies if we take at face value what we have been told about them. Isn't that right?
Yeah, it's a very good point that you make, and it's quite bizarre that there was more honesty about the Third Reich in, say, 1946 than there was in 1986, 1996, and 2015. You know, the propaganda against the period and against the German Chancellor is more hysterical and more bizarre now than it ever was before. And I very often say to people, you know, that you say, you're anti-Hitler, and I say, well, you don't know the man. You simply do not know the man. You know, what you do know is a parody of the man that has been created. You may as well say you don't like Mickey Mouse. Mickey Mouse does not exist. And the Adolf Hitler that you've been reading about through school and all the rest of it, he does not exist. And this is what I'm about to do with the books. And what I have been doing with my books is I have been giving them the different perspective, the other side of the coin. I am showing them not just an Adolf Hitler that is unrecognizable to them, but at least a true one, but a period, as I was just saying a little bit earlier. You know, Germany was one of the most prosperous. You know, people can't believe it. Now, these are basics, Henrik. Is people can't believe it that there were cruise liners, a whole fleet of cruise liners in the Third Reich that were built for no other purpose than to take ordinary people, engineers, nurses, labourers, farmers, on cruises around the Mediterranean at a time when only the very, very rich in the United States and Britain could afford such. Mm-hmm. This was the kind of society that they created. We've got the figures somewhere in my other book, Witness to History, about how few people went to the theatre and you know, opera and ballet, and all of these cultural pursuits before the Third Reich. And then through the Third Reich, they were getting free tickets to all of these shows, or low price. They were financed, subsidized by the state. So people became much better educated. It wasn't just physically better, they were mentally more prepared. And was it William L. Shearer in his book, The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich? He said, one of the amazing things that the Germans soldiers, the Waffen-SS and the Wehrmacht, couldn't get over was the poor physical state of the British soldiers that they were coming up against. Mm. You know, these Germans were, after 6 or 7 years of National Socialist Society, were wonderful, expressions of masculinity. They were physically and mentally, I always call them the last gladiators. But when they came across these weaklings suffering from rickets and every kind of disease known, I'm surprised that half the British soldiers were able to stand on their own 2 feet for very long.
You know, it seems to me today like the parasitical globalists that we have in place, they don't want to see the best expression of mankind kind of taking shape in the world and different nationalities kind of expressing their true potential or the properties that they have innate within them. It seems to me very much that the whole system is predicated on suppressing people on every level that they can. Look at our healthcare system, for example, how upside down it is and how it's largely about keeping people sick as opposed to keeping them healthy. And this seems to me is the world that we've gotten a beautiful, if you will, then facetiously expression of in our modern era. And that's the world that we have inherited to a certain extent, where even trying to better yourself, even trying to improve on the conditions that you have is almost looked down upon today. It's not only anti-intellectual, but it's, as you said, it's almost expression of bodily, perfection and things like this. It's very much looked down on, right?
Yeah, it's the opposite to National Socialism. What Western society has done is it's reduced Western women to not much better than sluts. They've put onto the pedestals and the podiums the cheapest and nastiest and the most immoral of women and held them up as, icons for the young women who are growing up today. And it's the same with the men, and masculinity, as you or I might think of masculinity, this is a thing of the past. And men have been, we've become the Kaffirs of South Africa, if you like. And, you're getting some ridiculous situations in Britain now. Even I can't write about it. I've only had two articles in a newspaper knocked back, and that's when I came to the defense of men. But, you had silly situations where a man in a theme park was taking a picture of his young daughter on a play slide, and all the women started shouting at him that he was a pedophile.
Oh, really?
And he was asked to leave. There was another guy who went out for a walk. He had a beer, a rural area. He decided to go for a walk in the woods. And the next thing, he was surrounded by police. He said, well, what have I done wrong? He said, you're acting suspiciously. He said, well, what am I doing? What? He said, I'm taking a walk in the woods. He said, no, you're acting suspiciously. So, this is Bolshevism, my friend. This is Bolshevism.
Wow. It's paranoia, everything is just kind of crumbling at the seams, it's just falling apart, it's unbelievable to see what has happened. And if these are the values that was fought for, if this is what so many human beings died for, to liberate us from the evil, as they've said, then wow, my God, what a bizarre world, isn't it?
Yeah, your generation, Henrik, is going to go through seismic change, I can tell you, and everything will be totally different in 10 years' time. I said in the 1980s is that the Berlin Wall had not been taken down. Everything had just been shifted to the other side. Mikhail Gorbachev said the same. Why are you trying to turn the European Union into a facsimile of the Soviet Union? Other people have said the same.
Yeah.
So all we've done is change places. And as I was writing a week or so ago, we always wondered, those of us who lived through the 50s and the 60s and the 70s, how could the Russian and Eastern European people be so complacent as to allow frontiers and the Berlin Wall to be built to keep them in? And today we are doing exactly the same. I think it's 10 up to 15 million euros are being spent on a 2,000-kilometer frontier in Ukraine, not to keep the Russians out of Europe, but to keep the Europeans from fleeing into Russia. So right. I think my prediction that we have simply changed places has come out true, and an editor of a newspaper that I used to write for Global Politics, and he said, Mike, he said, you send in an article, he said, I scratched my head and I wonder what the hell you've been on. And he said, 6 months later, he said, I put my head in my hands, he says, because it turned out exactly the way you said it would.
Yeah, interesting.
But yeah, I tell you now, Henrik, is the European Union now is where the Soviet Union was in 1985.
Sure.
It is 3 or 4 years away from, just collapsing. And what we're going to have now, I'm a little bit older than you, so I might not be around here to experience it. I wish you the best of luck, and it's going to be a rocky ride. You're going to go through the same situation as the people in the Soviet Union did in 1989, and that was complete economic collapse.
Yep.
They lost their pensions, they lost their rights to healthcare, education, the entire lot. It all disappeared. Where did it disappear to, Henrik? Now, as I say, I know a lot of Russian people. I'm married to a Ukrainian, bless her. And in the Soviet Union at the time, for her generation, we're not talking about Bolshevist Stalinists now, for her generation, life was very, very comfortable. It was, I suppose, in a way, it was a bit like Sweden. They were very, very comfortable, and they were protected from womb to tomb, and they all had a very, very secure future, and they could map out the rest of their lives. And then all of a sudden, Gorbachev, winds of change, all of that sort of stuff, the whole lot disappeared overnight. And the same thing is going to happen in the European Union. Everything that we take for granted today, including going down to the hole in the wall, at the bank to draw our money out, one of these days we're going to walk down there and it's going to be not working, and it's not going to work again. Mm-hmm. It's already happened in Cyprus. It's going to happen in Greece, and it's going to happen here too.
Yeah, look at the way the oligarchs sucked out the resources and the wealth from Russia. And I mean, I tell you, we don't have to get stuck on this, but Sweden is absolutely crumbling at the seams economically right now. We're being so incredibly overwhelmed with the economic system and in the way that Sweden is trying to carry the rest of the world on its shoulders, you know, with immigration and these kinds of issues. And it's just absolutely bankrupting itself and sucking itself dry. So, yeah, I think you're right. Something is definitely going to go down. And look at the euro, how much it's dropped to in the last couple of years here. It's on par with the dollar now almost, I think, which is unheard of recently. So, yep, something is about to go down. That's what we do here, you know.
You've got two ends of the European Union here. You've got Greece on the one side and you've got Finland on the other, and the Finnish economy is exactly the same parlor stage as that of Greece. So everybody is on board time. So, you know, life is never going to be the same again. And there's a very few of us who have got the perception to see it. And as for the rest of them, well, enjoy the ride.
Oh, man. Yeah, well, I guess, as I say, in those kinds of times, it's both, you know, an aspect of great opportunity and great danger. And things can turn very quickly when those kinds of things happen. It could be, at the end, turn out to be something very good. So, you know, we got to just keep fighting and trying to steer it in the right direction and get away from, you know, banker control and control of our countries and things like this. That's what's important here, I think.
Yeah, it's your generation, my friend, and I do wish you well with it, but, you know, there is going to be a mess to clean up, and it's your generation that's going to clean that mess up. I can only apologize for my lot. And, you know, and I'll give you a hand with the brush, you know, as far as I can.
We're going to clean it up. There's no question about that. I don't see there's any other option, really. It's either make it or break it on this level, I think. But let's get into a little bit here. We can take, you know, five or a little bit more here minutes of talking about Vidkun Quisling, and then we can, you know, continue and pick up in the second segment after we've taken a break. But let me just kind of get started on that topic a little bit here. Very interesting Norwegian politician. The word today, basically, Quisling in Swedish, basically means a coward, a turncoat, one who obviously collaborates with the enemy and these kinds of things. It become a very derogatory term. And I think I've never heard the opposite side to the story, in fact. I think I've never gotten any reasoning for why he did what he did or what happened there. Can you tell us about why you want to write about him and what you learned along the way?
Yeah, he's a great heroic figure for Norway and indeed for Scandinavia. Anybody who looks at the history, the background of Vidkun Quisling, couldn't fail to, even if they were opposed to his political opinions, they couldn't fail to admire the man. Excuse my pronunciations of the Swedish names and Swedish terms, but he was a great collaborator with Fridtjof Nansen, the polar explorer.
Yeah.
And the German troops, when they invaded Ukraine, they were a little bit bemused because in the peasants' huts and wherever they went, they saw pictures. No, not so much pictures, but icons in which Quisling was the main character with Our Lady. And wherever they went to Ukraine, there were pictures of Vidkun Quisling and Nansen. And the Germans, for whom Quisling was very much a minor peripheral figure at the time, they couldn't understand why this man was being considered as a god in this part of Russia and the Soviet Union. And it was because he, and working on behalf of the British government, I might say, and the International Red Cross, had brought so much aid to the Ukrainian people during the Holodomor, the Holocaust, the Ukrainian Holocaust, in which even Stalin conceded that 10 million had died. Now, you're talking a population and a country very similar in size to Spain. The population of Ukraine was about 40 million at the time. One in four had died of starvation.
Yep.
And the figures would have been far more tragic than that had it not been for heroic figures like Vidkun Quisling and Nansen, who did everything possible to organize aid and food going into these distressed areas. And it was estimated, it's difficult to put a precise figure to it, but nobody can doubt that many, many Ukrainians owe their lives to Vidkun Quisling. And if sanity ever returns to this world, then parks and avenues and shopping malls will be named after the man throughout Ukraine. He was such a heroic figure. He brought such aid. He was knighted for this by the British government. So his proper title is Sir Vidkun Quisling. As a physical man, as a moral man, I doubt that Norway has many equals to him. And yes, they talk to her, they talk as if he's a collaborator. In actual fact, he was sacked by the Germans because he refused to collaborate. But of course they don't know this. And, you know, the Germans, during the occupation of Norway, they put their own man in because Quisling was a little bit too rebellious for them.
Mm-hmm.
But the Germans there, of course, were, you know, they were there for a purpose, and that was to stop the British from invading Norway and attacking Germany through its back door across the Baltic Sea, which was totally unprotected. So when the British invaded Norway, and when the British actually did, I think it was April the 8th, mine the waters around Norway, which was absolutely contrary to international law. It was an act of war, and there were many acts of war by England at the time against Norway. And sensing that the British, quite rightly, were preparing to invade and occupy Norway, and then to carry on and invade Sweden, to give them access to northern Germany through the Baltic Sea, the Germans did what any sensible person did. They slammed the back door in England's face, and they did it very successfully. And Winston Churchill took a pounding, his troops took a pounding, which again was as humiliating as Churchill's, disaster in the Dardanelles and Dunkirk. And had the British not intended to invade Norway, then there was no way that the Germans were ever going to see reason to encroach upon the independence of Scandinavia. So there you are. Mm. But somebody had to stay there. And when the Germans did come in to Norway, then the entire government fled. They were hiding in the woods, or they were fleeing to Sweden. You know, they were cowards, every single one of them. Who had been goading for war. They all disappeared, leaving Vidkun Quisling to hold the baby. And, of course, the rest is history. But as a historical figure, as an achiever, as a Norwegian patriot, as a European patriot, as a hero for Eastern Europe, that man has no equals at all, and it is the power of propaganda that a man who should be lauded as a saint has been turned into a devil. That tells us much about the power of propaganda.
Wow, very interesting. I had no idea that he helped out in the Ukraine. That's a fascinating story. I definitely want to learn more about that. That's really interesting. And also, of course, despite then the fact that he refused in his own way to cooperate, and that, as you said, that he eventually was even, fired from his position because he wasn't willing to work with the Germans. Despite that aspect, he still wasn't recognized. He was still pointed out as a horrible man, and it's to me then horrible that his name has been associated with that. It's been smeared in the way that it has, and that we haven't gotten the right story about him. Very interesting indeed.
Well, it's the same in France, wasn't it? Field Marshal Pétain.
Vichy government, right?
The Vichy government, when the rest of the French government, like cowards, just fled, they dropped the baby in Pétain's hands, and he made a very good job of it. And, France occupied France, did very, very well. And so Field Marshal Pétain, a hero of the First World War, very much adored by the French, but very, very similar in many respects to Vidcon Quisling. He was left to hold the baby, and now he's being crucified for that. And those who were involved in the assassination, I'm not going to call it a firing squad or an execution in the assassination of Vidcon Quisling, their names will be infamous throughout history.
Is it guilt by association? Do you think primarily the people are so afraid of even touching these people that they just basically say they denounce them because of the very fact that they managed to keep a government in place while they were occupied by Germany, and that's enough to demonize them?
Yeah, well, it's not just that to demonize them. You've got to remember at the end of the war, you know, the mentality of the Allies is very, very similar with that of the Soviet Union, and that was to get rid of any people of great influence that could rock the boat after the war had ended, after the German armed forces had surrendered.
Yeah.
And so just as the Soviets got rid of the head, the Indian chiefs, if you like, of the Baltic states and Poland with the disgraceful massacres in the Katyn forests elsewhere, it was the same with the Allies. Anybody who was in a position of great influence, if they possibly could, William Joyce. They didn't want the likes of William Joyce writing down his memoirs. They certainly don't want the likes of Vidcon Quisling writing down his memoirs. So the easy answer is to assassinate them, but to dress it up as a judicial execution.
Now let's talk more about that when we return. We're going to take a break here in a little bit and talk some more about not only Quisling, but some of the other people that you bring up in the book, Mike. But let's give out the titles to some of the books we want to talk about here. And by the way, I just want to also mention we have not too far from now coming up here on the 8th of May. It's about 70 years ago here since the Germans surrendered in the Second World War. So I guess this is a timely release of your books as well to offer people a different side of the story, and of course try to get to a little bit more of an objective view of what actually happened and whatnot. But please go ahead and mention your website and some of the titles you like to give. You said you had a lot of them coming out here, but go ahead and fire off as many as you want there, Mike.
I don't want to give the titles of the forthcoming books because I do suffer a lot from piracy. You know, Mike Walsh has become something of a brand. I've stopped being a human being somewhere along the tracks. But this year, Heroes of the Reich. So if anybody goes onto Amazon Books and writes in Mike Walsh, Heroes of the Reich, or Mike Walsh, Heroes Hang when Traitors Triumph, then they're going to come up with the books, and they're going to come up with the third one now that has just been published fortuitously today, and this is The All Lies Invasion, which is a play on words, of course, Allies or All Lies. And this is a chronicle of the lies, the spin, that was put on the run-up to the Second World War and during the war. So people were well used to the lies and the spin about Iraq and Afghanistan and Libya and Iran. And you ain't seen nothing yet. You wouldn't believe the amount of lies and propaganda about Germany which influenced people into fighting for the Allies. And now they're waking up to it. So, yeah, three books, Heroes of the Reich. The second book is Heroes Hanged When Traitors Triumph, and the All Lies Invasion. So there's three books there, and they will totally revolutionize anybody else's thinking. As they turn the pages, they will scratch their head and they'll say, wow, I never knew that.
Right, very good. Amazon.com will have those linked up here. I want to ask you more about the other books we haven't talked about yet in the second as well, so we'll get to that. You also, of course, you do some poetry, Mike, and people can find more of that on michaelwalsh.es, I believe. Is that correct?
Yeah, michaelwalsh.es. You'll find the poetry there. And because they're so separate poetry and, you know, the Third Reich and all this sort of thing and Bolshevism, then I like to keep them separate. But not many people realize in the political side of things that I'm probably better known throughout the world as a poet. In England, in the year 2000, I was the most popular contemporary poet in Britain. My poetry books were selling at an unbelievable rate. Now, I'll give you an example of that, Henrik, is that if you go into the Writers and Artists Yearbook, because poetry isn't the flavour of the month with many people, they say, don't even bother publishing more than 500 copies. This idiot published 3,000 copies, and they were all sold within several weeks. So, yeah, the poetry that I composed has got a wide audience, and it's very, very nice to have people write to me, and thousands have written to me. I'm on YouTube, by the way, and I'm breaking all records there. People writing to me and say, I never read poetry in my life, but now I can't leave it alone now that I'm yours. So this is a nice compliment. I have done what Mozart did with music. I have given poetry back to the people. I have taken poetry away from the pretentious. You're no longer scratching your head and wondering what the hell this guy is on about. You're scratching your heart and you're empathizing with, I'm speaking from heart to heart.
All right, very good. MikeWalsh.es is the website for that, and we're going to have that linked up as well. But all right, we'll take a short break here, and we'll be right back with more. Stay with us, everybody. We'll be right back. As we proceed at redicemembers.com in the second hour, we delve deeper into the story of the Holodomor, the genocide of the ethnic Ukrainian people carried out by the Soviet Union. Mike explains how the Bolshevik occupied Russia, robbed and starved the Ukrainians as a means to repay Wall Street for financing the Russian Revolution. Later we look at today's shifting political narrative and the watering down of negative publicity encircling violent and radical factions that are being used for NATO's ends. We discuss how National Socialism could have been seen as one of the only viable options in the fight against communism, and conversely, how communism once seemed to be a feasible way out of the suffering brought on by capitalism or industrialization. At the end, we compared the current state of the EU and US to what's happening in the Eastern Bloc 25 years ago, emphasizing the importance of reconciling the past century of history in order to understand the root of our present identity crisis. You can tune into the second hour and all our previous radio programs, videos, TV episodes, and more that we have for you at redicemembers.com. Subscribe and tune into an independent radio program that seeks to understand why things are the way they are and what we can do about it. We have more coming, folks, with Kevin McDonald, Gilad Atzmon, Ulla Damegård, Colin Ross, Greg Johnson, Tom Rousel, Victoria Clark, Christopher Hell, Stephen McNallan, and others. Second hour coming right up. Thank you for listening.